Hey, I'm Peter Mudlin, and you are listening to Teacher's Lounge. And if this is your first time hearing our education show, I mean, great news. It's a super simple idea that we've just all had teachers in our lives who helped us become who we are today. And every educator we have on this podcast, whether a teacher, a coach, or professor, is nominated by the people who listen. So we want you to be a part of this show with us. Please tell us about the educators who've inspired you in your life and the folks in your community who deserve a spotlight. Again, email us with your nominations at teachersloungeniu.edu. Now today on the show, it is Tina Hardy. She's the coordinator for the Center of Accessibility and Neurodiversity at Illinois Valley Community College. Basically, it's her job to make college accessible for students who need extra accommodations. And that could look like more time to write during a test if you've got a physical impairment that affects your writing. It could mean helping students use software to record lectures and take notes. And you know, the laws, they change quite a bit when students with disabilities move from high school to college. So Tina helps students with that transition. But before my conversation with Tina, I have one more education story I want to share. Several school districts in Northern Illinois are reckoning with multi-million dollar budget deficits this spring and cuts to classroom positions. The Freeport School Board recently voted to eliminate dozens of staff positions because of their projected $11 million budget deficit. Kelly Everding is the president of the Freeport Education Association and is a history teacher at the high school.
We're definitely going to see students who struggle with reading and math be impacted at the elementary level. We're going to see students who utilize the library and library lessons impacted.
Everding says this is the first time in over 30 years that Freeport's dealing with staffing cuts this severe. But it's not just them. Rockford Public Schools just axed over 100 positions because of their $15 million deficit. Harlem is closing down two schools. Even higher income districts like Naperville aren't safe. Its board just voted down proposed staffing cuts meant to reduce their $12 million deficit. Emily Warnicke says it is a perfect storm of expenses increasing while support slips away. She works in government relations with the state's school administrators and school business official groups. And for her, one of the biggest reasons for this storm is a sharp increase in the cost of mandated categorical spending. Now, as the name implies, these are mandated school services like busing, the transportation of special ed students, and educating special education students who learn at dedicated facilities. Schools spend money on these services, file a claim with the state, and then get a certain amount reimbursed.
What we've seen with that over the last couple of years, mainly since COVID, is that those claims are going up annually year over year by a rate of 13%. Prior to COVID, we were seeing historically about a 2% increase.
Take Rockford Public Schools, for example. In 2022, the state reimbursed pretty much all of their special education transportation and a lot of their regular transportation, too. And the local district was left to foot the bill for the remaining $800,000. Fast forward to 2026, costs have gone up and reimbursements have stayed the same. So now that bill is up to $7.5 million. And Warnicke says it's not something districts anticipated. And another factor here is the cost of health care. Jason Bloom is an administrator at the Harlem School District.
We've seen an increase of almost 38% in 4 years. Like, you know, we're pushing $20 million in health care costs. Like, that's a big, big cost.
Rockford Public School Superintendent Aaron Jarrett is dealing with the same thing.
When you have a 6% increase 1 year and then a 6% increase the next year, it builds on it. And unfortunately, that's how you go from a budget surplus to a budget deficit pretty quickly. And unfortunately, the only way to get ahead of this was to cut back on some staff.
During the pandemic era, schools often added support staff for mental health and academic intervention. And during that period, they also had access to federal relief funding called ESSER. It expired in the fall of 2024. So if schools used it for those roles, they now have to find another way to pay for it, which becomes even more difficult when healthcare and transportation costs surge at the same time. Add on top of that uncertainty around federal funding for education, and you've got a perfect storm and multi-million dollar deficits. But in some districts like Freeport, people feel like this isn't simply a story of choppy waters that schools are all trying to sail through. Kelly Everding says their board's poor financial stewardship is also to blame for their deficit.
We had some building maintenance issues that were deferred for many years. Had we worked on those earlier, that might have, you know, lessened the cost as well.
And Emily Warnicke says it's hard to predict just how long some of these challenges like inflation will stick around, but she says a few of these issues can be solved or at least soothed. It's why her groups are advocating for the state to increase reimbursement rates for those mandated categorical costs like special ed transportation. If not, she says, the financial reality for schools will be even more dire, and even more may have to consider cuts. All right. Now it's time for my conversation with Illinois Valley Community College's Tina Hardy. And we start off talking about just how different special education law is at the K-12 level compared to her work at the college level.
K-12 level, like, you are legally obligated to provide certain accommodations, but at the college level, like, things are very different. Like, those laws don't necessarily apply to colleges in the same way that they do high schools.
Right. So how I talk about it is through IDEA in K-12, students have the right to success because accommodations and modifications can happen.
Right.
When students come to college, the laws change. We're under Americans with Disabilities Act and Section 504 of the Rehab Act, and those laws are about access. And while I want all the students I work with to be successful, my job under the law is not to guarantee success. It's to make sure they have equitable access under the law. And we do that through accommodations, but we don't have to modify or fundamentally alter curriculum in order to provide those accommodations. So my job is a balance between student access and what instructors deem reasonable. And instructors are the ones who determine what a reasonable accommodation is, and my job is to be the middle person to do the crosstalk between those two.
Right, so they get to decide, like, hey, this is fundamentally altering my curriculum or not. In some ways, even saying, like, I think this is a fair and reasonable accommodation, or if we're going over the line to, like, somehow making it easier or altering it in a significant way.
Right. Right.
As the way that you have approached that work, has it evolved over the years that you've been doing it?
Not so much. I think the basis of the work is establishing trust with all parties, first of all. Helping students know that, yes, I am an advocate for their access. Also establishing trust across campus with faculty to help them understand there's a process for determining this and a protocol, and I respect what they respect as fundamental to their curriculum. The only thing I think that changes is sometimes expectations of students and or parents, because they may or may not understand the shift in the laws and what can happen. But I haven't run into a whole lot of barriers when I do intake with students. I go point by point over their rights and responsibilities, and I explain that. It's a lot of language, but I try to explain that as best I can right from the get-go.
I'm sure a lot of communication, like, with the professors and instructors too, right? Like, are there situations where, you know, you'll present something to them or whoever that works, and they'll say, I think this is maybe a little bit over the line. I think this is, you know, maybe altering the curriculum a little bit too much. And then you say, okay, well, can we do this? And you have that back and forth until you can arrive at somewhere where you can both agree to.
Yeah. And that's nuanced work, and that takes a lot of doing sometimes.
Right. And so, like, that's also interesting for you guys, because at the community college level, obviously a lot of students are coming out of high school with that system. They're going to you, and then they might go from you to a different college. And, you know, what their, you know, again, that line between access and success and how colleges provide these certain accommodations, does it look a lot different depending on the college?
It shouldn't. We're all following the same laws.
Okay,
but
good.
There's probably a slight variability.
Okay.
I think there are some accommodations that are a little bit trickier than others, like flexible attendance and participation. If students have chronic medical or mental health issues and they need flexible attendance and participation, how that looks mm-hmm. can be different. It's generally an accommodation that you'd see.
Right.
But that one, you can be all over the place with that, because that one is one that bumps up into fundamental alteration a lot. If there are, like, for instance, there are programs here where attendance is mandatory. It's mandated not even by the college, but maybe by the state.
Okay, yeah.
There's not really much room to wiggle in there. And I've been working through something with that a little bit this week. Where is the give? Where is there absolutely no give? But most of us follow the same broad guidelines with probably just little tweaks in how certain things play out in the end. But it should be
right.
pretty standard.
And again, like, you're working with a very, very broad range of students, right? Mm-hmm. Like, we talk about your center's working with, obviously, students with disabilities. And that, you know, again, like, are they visible? Are they invisible? Like, disabilities is a very broad range, too. Also, you know, medical or mental health related things. Can you give us just, again, I know this is very different and very dependent student to student, but some examples of some common ways that you guys are supporting those students?
Sure. I would say almost regardless of what the diagnosis is that a student has that comes through my office, a common accommodation that's requested is extended test time or alternate test setting. Those are probably the most accommodations sure. put in place, because you think about if people have challenges with reading or processing information, you might need more time. If you have trouble with focus, where you're in and out of focus, you might need more time. If you have a physical impairment that limits your ability to write or type, you might need more time. If you have a mental health diagnosis, sometimes you need more time to self-regulate and refocus. So that's a common accommodation.
Right.
So that's done. I support quite a few students with a note-taking program called Genio. It's something that a lot of students coming out of high school have never seen, and adult students certainly haven't had access to. It helps students not only capture lecture information by recording it, allows them to mark important features in real time so they can go
Is
back.
Is it like
and,
a transcription type of service?
And it does transcribe, so students get audio.
Yeah.
They can mark important points that they want to go see. They don't have to re-listen to the whole lecture again. It fully transcribes, and then it gives them multiple ways to work with the information on the back end of, you know, making their notes more robust by adding pictures, adding definitions. They can take a short quiz based on the content they just heard. So that's pretty common. I get 75 licenses that the institution buys, and the past couple semesters I've loaned almost all those out.
That's another thing, though, with accessibility, right? The technology that's available to you now is probably very different than when you started doing this work.
That's a funny... Yes, it is. Yes, yeah. It is. I mean, yeah, I joke that maybe I will... I should have a little museum of the things. The thing that's changed the most is textbooks and alternate texts. Because when I first started, you know, we had books. Which sounds true. We had books.
At a school? You're kidding.
At a school. We had books. Yeah. And that wasn't accessible for a lot of people. So I had to get alternate formats where people could listen. And back then, I had a system where I ordered and they would send us literally boxes of cassette tapes with the books
right.
on them.
It's like those terms that people still use. Like, someone will still say book on tape, even if they mean like a digital download. But
yeah.
like, we're talking about literal tapes here.
Tapes to CDs to digital formats. And now what's happening is the reverse. We have all digital text, not all, but almost all digital textbooks that are accessible, right?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, students can enlarge print. They can listen to the text. But I'm running into lots of students who want actual books. And books are getting harder. Textbooks are getting harder to find. So, and they're very
things,
expensive.
I was going to say that because I've done some reporting and some work talking to people in like visual disability programs
mm-hmm.
and just about how wildly expensive some of those books can be with like enlarged print and whatever it might be.
Yeah. So it's been that's a particularly interesting run. Note taking has been the same. You know, we used to have very old school ways of hiring student note takers to support, sure. make copies. They used to, way back in the day, have like mimeograph type paper. I can't even think about it.
Yeah, no, I know what you're talking about, though.
Oh
I can't
gosh,
remember the
I've
term for
lost
either.
The term. It used to be that, you know, and now we've gone from that to, you know, Genio has been really, it's been a great product for us. And I know there's other things out there that allow students to record, but I've been with the same company. Genio's rebranded a couple different times or has different iterations, but I've had them for a long time now.
We've seen the full pendulum swing to digital and now the start of the swing back towards some physical media that people are requesting.
Well, I think what's happening is with everything on digital, it gets really distracting for 100%,
students.
100%. And if students have like a test that's online and they can use, and you say it's Open Note or Open Book, they're flipping between a test and another screen. And for people who are distracted already,
yeah,
or struggle with processing information or struggle with technology, it's created its own barriers and challenges, and where people just say, I just want to look it up.
Yeah. I think that's a trend even beyond, you know, what you guys do, right? That people who are younger really want to physically own things.
So, but
you know what I mean? Like you say, I was literally just listening to an interview with, you know, people in like the book industry. And it's the same thing where like they thought that ebooks were going to destroy the print physical market, and that they're finding that younger people are like, no, I look at enough screens throughout my day-to-day life.
Right. Know? And I don't know if we'll be able to go back. I don't know. You know, now we can get some loose leaf, cheaper versions of some books.
Right.
Sometimes, again, it's a cost and, you know, being able to find the resource thing. It's a mix between the two of them. And students who have already paid for a digital textbook as part of their tuition do not want to pay large sums of money for an additional actual book.
Well, I wanted to ask, too, about, you know, we've obviously went through some of what your day-to-day can kind of look like. And I'm sure it depends. It's very different day-to-day. Probably if it's probably difficult to describe like what a typical day for you looks like.
Yeah. I mean, I guess that's part of the reason why I like my job, because there aren't a lot of typical days, but many days are sometimes wall-to-wall with students, which is great. Meeting with students, especially like at the beginning of a semester, making sure they're set up with their accommodations, doing that one after another, doing intake or setting up accommodations or asking questions, make sure people are set. I'm on a lot of committees here, and I think it's important that I am. So I go to meetings. I could be doing presentations or workshops. I could be in classrooms promoting my services, all of that.
So an ideal day for you, maybe all students or a little bit of everything?
A little bit of everything. Yeah. I like working with students, but sometimes due to the nature of the work and depending upon, you know, what I need to do sometimes, there's a lot to do because there's the meeting time with a student. But for every student you meet with, it's probably another half hour, 45 minutes or hour of follow-up depending upon the situation. So a mix is great.
So we talked about, again, some of the day-to-day, some of the interesting, you know, technology, some of the challenges. But, like, I wanted to ask if you've had any moments recently. And, again, this could be a presentation. This could be a committee. This could be a meeting with a student or something. But just something where things went really well and you were like, actually, this is why I love what I do.
Yeah. I think one thing, and it might not feel like a big deal to people, but I had someone come in and we were discussing accommodations, not just for a class, but maybe for a licensure test that's coming down the road. And we really dug into talking about why learning feels hard for this person. It went beyond just talking about accommodations. We were talking about why learning feels hard, dug into a little history, how this is an adult student who took a long time to get to college because of the shame she felt about how much she struggled. And she's here, she's doing well, but she's taking hard classes and it takes a lot. And She went to a private school. She didn't have much testing. So she hasn't had a whole lot of like actual verifiable information as to why learning is so hard. She does have one diagnosis, but I think there's multiple. And we had a really good conversation about that. And we not only got to talk about what's hard, but what great skills she's also bringing to the table. And I think, and I'm hoping she left that situation feeling a little bit better, not just focusing on the hard stuff, but what she can bring to the table. So those are the things. You know, it's always student-centered. Those are always the best days when you can get to know someone a little bit better or have meaningful conversations, go beyond just the work of the day-to-day.
Yeah. And I'm sure those conversations can be a shortcut to having some, again, really kind of profound conversations about, and again, like these are really vulnerable things to talk about too, about why learning is a challenge. But also, again, you get to not just focus on the challenge part of that, but also, you know, what their strengths are too as a student and as a person.
Yeah. And we call it like demystifying things, because I don't think most students have a lot of time to talk about that with people. So try to get to the core of that.
I wanted to ask too, and funny enough, this got referenced a couple months ago on this show because I interviewed one of your friends, Ashley Carls, and we were talking about the Get Set program, which, again, we talked about the differences between high school and college, and that is a program about transitioning from high school to college. Is that, can you explain again for folks that maybe haven't heard that and are curious about what Get Set is? Can you explain a little bit?
Get Set is an effort on my part to be proactive about college readiness. I think many of us who have worked in the space here at college have seen the barriers that people face when they're not ready for college, and it's a effort to get ahead of it. Because what I see is when students show up here on day one, and if they aren't well prepared with all the logistics of college and all the language and all the technology and all of that, what they're trying to do is, as they start their classes, they're juggling classes and all this other, what I would call college knowledge stuff. And it becomes overwhelming for students. So I'm like, we know these things, so let's get ahead of that. So I developed a summer bridge program. It's 5 half days. It's usually done 2 to 3 weeks before school starts. It's free for any student. Day one is college knowledge. First thing we do is make sure students know their technology, know lingo, they take a tour, they meet the resource people. Day two is general study skills. I never know who's coming, so I don't know where they're at with this on the study skills thing. But general things that are needed are, how do you read a textbook? How do you take notes? How do you get information in and out of your brain? You know, study. How do you do that? Day three is time management. Day four is goal setting, motivation, career readiness. And day five is self-regulation and well-being. And then we set those students up with a mentor for the fall semester. And those mentors generally are staff people. They could be professional tutors. They could be all sorts of staff people that check it in with them, ideally 5 times at week 1, 4, 8, 12, and 16, just to make sure they got another touch point.
Yeah. How long have you guys been doing it?
We've had... I think 4 years, I think. We've had a small, you know, 75, 85 people through it, but good feedback
from the students. I was going to say, like, do you feel like it's gone well?
It's gone well, and I have evidence of that because I was mindful enough somehow to make sure I had. We did daily evaluations. We did pre-test, post-test stuff. So we have some reasonably good data on students and what they think of it and how their skills have jumped and things like that. So the words that I use for Get Set are confidence, competence, and connection. Any research on college retention will tell you that's what it's all about. And that's what we try to establish early on.
I could totally see how it would be super helpful. Like, I'm thinking about myself, particularly with like the technology platforms that you have to get to know on a really quick basis when you start off, just like literally knowing where your assignments are going to be, where you have to submit, all that stuff. Again, that's beyond just what the coursework is. It's just like you have to figure that out before you can even do what your assignments.
Yeah, and some of that, we can teach them where to go, we can help them anticipate, but like the courses don't actually open up till day one or very shortly before that. So we get them thinking about that at least, and we build the foundation. And those are the measures that have come through the strongest. Like within an hour of having our student learning technologies people come in to get set, I ask students before, how have you rated your skills, and after they've been there for that hour. And we've had such significant jumps, 40, 50, 60, 70% increase in confidence. And that's such a big deal.
Yeah. Again, I know that you've been a part of lots of other different programs, initiatives, thing on campus. One of them I also wanted to ask about was Minds of All Kinds. Can you tell me about that?
Yeah. There are a lot of student groups on campus.
Yeah.
And I can't remember the impetus. I think it's probably been 2 or 2.5 years ago. Actually, it was a conversation with a student that started this, and I thought, I wonder if we should have a student group for students either who have disabilities or learning differences or who are interested in that.
Right.
And I had a really good core group of students a couple of years ago who had high interest and were willing to help move things along. It's always been a very small group, but we've done some really interesting things, whether it's having conversations about you know, just topics that surround disability, because people, you know, people sharing, getting in a group and saying, this is me and I have this diagnosis. And then other people get to hear that and share common things, or raising awareness on campus about neurodiversity. You know, my office used to be called Disability Services, and several years ago we switched to Center for Accessibility and Neurodiversity. And we found that a lot of people, like, they don't even really understand the term neurodiversity or neurodivergent. Sure. So we've raised awareness around campus. I've tried to also, with that group, let people on campus know that when you are developing policies or procedures or operationally changing things, there's a group of students here that please ask. It goes back to the Nothing About Me, Without Me movement of people with disabilities. If you're planning things for that group, ask the people. So so I've wanted to build that with that group again. It's awareness and advocacy and connection. So it's small, and sometimes because I'm a one-person shop, it's hard to keep that all rolling. But, sure. I, you know, we've tried to do good things throughout.
It's another place that we were mentioning, like with you meeting with students, that it's a way to kind of create a shortcut to having those deep conversations about, you know, things that we're maybe vulnerable about, but also can help you feel connected, less alone, to people that are, you know, have similar things.
Right. And disability identity was one of those topics where that formed for them. How there's whole theories about that.
Yeah.
And nobody, we don't have a class necessarily on that. So we did that a little bit. We've had Dr. Maureen Dunn here, who's a cognitive neuroscience. She's an author, and she met with students and had conversations with them. So we've tried to use that group as a seed group for when we have these bigger conversations, to be in that audience so they can hear from people like her. We had Amy Marie Brielle here, who's representative, who is identifies clearly as neurodivergent, and she came and talked to the group. So it's about that awareness raising, but creating in an inner core of seeing really competent people out in the world, also identifying as neurodivergent and doing their thing. And
the other thing I wanted to ask about too, and we've actually had a conversation about this a couple of years ago, is that you've been a part of the One Book, One College. Are you still a part of that?
I am. This year, we've had quite a few switches at the campus, so it's not going as strongly as it has in years past, but last year, the book that was chosen was Disability Visibility. And so One Book, One College gives the campus an opportunity to focus on a book, focus on a topic, and talk about it broadly and widely, or, you know, around campus. So I was so happy that the topic was disability, because that did give us a platform to have more conversations. Me going into classes and talking about accessibility a little bit more as an auxiliary, you know, aid to the textbook itself. And so that did open wide doors. This year we picked a book that centers on AI, which would be great conversations. It's just there is a lot going on campus, and we've got a lot of new people in places. So it hasn't jumped up maybe to the level of things we've done before, but it's still going. So
yeah. Well, it's just interesting too with, you know, like student organizations too that we talked about, where at the community college level, like students could be here for 1 year to get a certificate. They could be here for two right. years to get an associate degree. They could be here for 3 years doing, like, it's such a range. Whereas, again, I think that we think about student organizations like a four-year school where you're like, you could be part of the same thing for 4 years. Yeah. That when there's more turnover, could make it a little bit more difficult to, like, maintain these things because you get a new yeah. group of students every couple of years.
And it's hard. And there's a lot of competing things going on, too, here. A lot of student yeah. groups. And these students are, you know, community college students are working.
Exactly.
And so it's hard to get people all around the table, you know, because they come and go and because they're very busy.
They've got to go to work afterwards. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah. So we just do our best to make sure we still try to do things. Like, I missed the meeting. I couldn't pull a meeting together in March, but we hosted what we call a meet and eat, and we did that coming out of COVID.
Food is always the best. Like, if you want to lure anyone somewhere, right. you got to have food.
Yeah. So, and what it was is like speed conversations. We said, we'll provide the topics, you come and talk. So we lined people up on both sides of the table and just provided them with topic starters, and then they'd shift around every 3-4 minutes, talk to new people. And so we did that. And then right on the heels of that, we were supposed to have a meeting. And I'm like, oh, my gosh, I didn't get to that. But the we had a nice group for that. So I thought that served many purposes, just those conversation skills that you had to be face-to-face. No one was on their phones checking things. So, and I recorded, actually, the audio of that because I thought it was so great.
Did you do pizza? Is that still the most common
yes,
spread
easiest,
when you need that?
Yes, yeah. Pizza and conversation. Yeah.
I wanted to ask a little bit about your kind of teacher origin story, how you became a teacher in the first place here, if you yeah. will indulge me yeah. for a moment. Yeah. But are you someone who thought about wanting to become a teacher when you were a kid? Was it something that came to you later in life? Like, how did you come to it?
Yeah, I'd like to say there was a super clear path to this job. There was not. I've always worked professionally in the space of working with people with disabilities or learning differences.
Let's stay there really quick. How did that start for you then?
Well, I'll go back to my education background.
Yeah.
My education background is I have a bachelor's degree in psychology, and one soon learns that while when you choose a major like that and you want to say very broad, your career choices are not, with a bachelor's degree in psychology, the greatest. So I did a little bobbing and weaving through master's degree stuff, and I was not finding the right fit. So I said, I'm going to go to work. So I landed at Kreider Services in Dixon, which is similar to Horizon House in this area. They serve adults with developmental disabilities. And I was what they call a QMRP and a behavior specialist there. So I supervised a group home and then later wrote behavior plans for clients.
Oh, wow.
But I had to do training while I was in that role. And I found out I really liked that. And I was That was relatively easy for me, and I got good feedback when I was training. And as I was thinking about what I wanted to do when I grew up, I kind of combined the idea of, well, I'm working with adults with some sort of disability or learning difference, and I like training. And that just led, obviously, to, I'm like, well, I'll do a master's degree in special ed. I wanted to get a master's degree, and I was chasing that down and couldn't find the right niche. So I ended up settling on that. I went to Northern and got a master's degree in special ed. And right around that time, I also had my first son and decided I did not want to be in a classroom full time. It just wasn't, the timing wasn't right, but a part-time job here at IVCC in disability services at that time came up. And because of my background, I seemed to be a pretty good fit. So I landed in that. I did that. I'd been, I did that role for 14 years part-time. And then while I was part-time, I could do other things. I could teach. I taught all sorts of different things. I taught psychology. I taught child growth and development. I taught study skills, strategies for college, all sorts of different things because I like that. And then you just find out, it kind of found me. I didn't find it. And then after the last 10 years, I've been full-time in my role in Center for Accessibility. So I don't have much time to teach, but all of this sort of found me.
Yeah.
I know. And I think it's okay to say that because I meet a lot of students who think everybody who gets to where they are, it was magical and purposeful and planned. And I am evidence that I would have never dreamed that this is the role I would have been in when I was in college. I didn't even know about jobs like this.
Right. And how sometimes, like in retrospect, certain experiences that you have make sense where you're like, okay, I can kind of reverse engineer how I got here, but I could have never predicted that that's what I was doing at the time.
Oh, yeah. No, there was no map, but it's all worked out, you know, and I've been here a long time. I've been here at the college 25 years, so it's been a good fit for me because I get to wear a lot of hats, and I like it. I get to use a lot of skill sets.
Yeah. It is very helpful, though, I think, for students, because I remember feeling that way, too, that, again, like, everyone knew since they were 5 years old that they wanted to be a marine biologist, and then they became a marine biologist. I didn't have that experience at all.
No. That's how I got here, and, yeah, I enjoy working with students. If I ever get the opportunity to teach again, I probably would welcome that, too, probably at the college level.
Do you miss that at all?
A little bit, yeah. Teaching is really creative work, and I love that, and you know, when I taught psychology, when I stopped doing that, I don't know how long I did that, many semesters. I had just gotten the class to the point where I loved it. And then I had to step away because you can't do all the things all the time. So you have to say no to some things sometimes. And I had to stop teaching in that capacity because it was too much.
Maybe one day you'll get to come back to it. You know?
Yeah, maybe.
I read it was kind of a blogger column that you wrote a couple of years ago that was about like coming out of the pandemic, that it was an opportunity for, like, you know, colleges to be able to kind of re-examine how we're supporting students, especially with all the, like, kind of mental health challenges that came with that. And I think that it's something you've seen education broadly, that there's been a lot more investment into the kind of mental health side of things and mental health supports. And I was curious, I mean, now that we're, like, you know, it's been 5 or 6 years, and I think the article that you wrote was from a few years back now, do you feel like it has evolved quite a bit since the pandemic of, you know, that re-examining how mental health supports work?
Yeah. Even pre-COVID, the rates of mental health challenges on campuses were climbing. And then, of course, COVID really exacerbated all of that. Since then, you know, the state has kicked into gear and has, you know, mandated some mental health supports on campuses. And that's really been welcome here because prior to having designated mental health services and therapists on campus through a group called Transformative Growth here, people like my office, people like me in my office, and our counselors or academic advisors were doing our jobs, but also managing many of the mental health things, as were instructors, as were many other staff people. And many of us, while we are familiar with mental health, we are not clinical professionals.
Right. Right.
So what I've seen is just more and more support, and through the state's efforts. I can't think of the name of the law, but we have therapy on campus. I was just in a meeting yesterday. We have therapists on campus, and we're even adding another level of crisis support on top of that. So when we are on break, when it's after hours, students will have the ability to call a crisis line and get support there. I think overall awareness of mental health issues across campus has been raised. There have been mental health first aid trainings. There's just all sorts of stuff that really has amped up since COVID. And I don't know. I don't know if things have evened out, actually, but I know supports have been bolstered more.
Right,
and more.
When you see more need, hopefully there's been more supports alongside that.
Yeah. So, yeah, that's a lot of change. And, you know, through my office, numbers change about, you know, diagnoses that students show up with. But, you know, probably what I've seen is more and more students with a diagnosis of anxiety. It's often paired with anxiety and depression if we're having mental health diagnosis. And what I've seen is multiple diagnoses, many, you know, one, two, three, four diagnoses. But it's nice to have more resources here.
Absolutely. Then you're, that would be very disheartening if you were like, I'm seeing all these things and the supports aren't there to match it, you know, that would be more difficult.
Right. And another thing, I guess, you know, way before this, years ago, I wrote a grant and we brought on something called You at IVCC, which is the digital well-being portal. And that's before we had therapists on campus. And we recognized that, you know, we're working with students who may not want to sit across the desk from someone, may not have the time, may not have the resources to get therapy. And You at IVCC isn't meant to be
a one-to-one replacement, right?
But it was a way for students to anonymously get onto the portal and look up a myriad of resources in the form of short articles, videos, facts, and tips about all sorts of things that college-age students might deal with as a resource. So we have that. We have peer mentors now. We have therapists, you know, trainings, all sorts of stuff.
One of the questions we always ask everyone is about teachers in their life who inspire them. Again, this could be someone, this could be the first grade teacher that you had growing up. This could be someone who you work with now. Just who comes to mind?
Well, I thought about that a little bit, and I think the answer is literally, I'm not making this up. All my best friends are teachers. And they're...
accident, I'm sure.
I don't know how that happens, because you can make friends all over the place. But literally, every one of my best friends is a teacher. So I think of them right away when I think of people who help me be better. Because there are a lot of people who don't do the work I do. My work is really specific. So Ashley Carls, my friend.
Shout out.
Give
Teacher's
her
Lounge
a big... she does know what I do. We share the same thing. So what's really great when we get to work together is the shared affinity and mission. And that really perks me up, especially when she comes in and does get set with me in the summers. It's really great. It revives me a little bit knowing that I know someone who knows the same things I do. But then all my other friends who work in all different spaces, some of them are master level, not master's degree, but master level certification teachers who have honed their craft, understand child development, understand what kids need, and are able to really, you know, use their creative skills to help kids of all ages and all spaces. So those are the people that I surround myself with, and they keep me going.
I was going to say, I'm sure that helps if you're ever feeling a little bit burnt out, have a couple conversations with them.
Yeah. Whether to commiserate or get a little additional push, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Whatever you need.
Yeah.
You know, you've been at IVCC for about 25-ish
It's 25
years now.
Yep.
I'm curious, again, just about you've been at this place for that long now, just one or two of your favorite things about this school, particularly since you have that insight of being here for that long.
Yeah. I think probably at this stage in my career, my most favorite thing is what I affectionately call the oldies but goodies. There's been a crew of us that have been together a long time here. We've seen...
Also great for commiserating or whatever you need, right?
And we've just weathered a lot of changes together. We've built mutual trust and respect. And, you know, it's people, the boots on the ground like that, especially the people you've known and worked with for a really long time. That's one of my most favorite things about working here. And many of us are all of the same age, and I see a time not too far down the road where we're all, you know, getting closer to thinking about retirement. So those times and years become really precious because we've just done so much together. So I think that's probably my most favorite thing, collaborating, having friendships in the place that you work. Kids getting married, our kids having babies, you know, you just have a lot of life. You know, you have life here inside the school, but you have a lot of life outside the school that you've shared too. So
my last question for you, Tina, is just what's something about your work and about accessibility that you just wish more people knew about or think is more important than people realize?
I think in short form, I'll say that difference doesn't equal deficit. That's an important mindset, that just because someone thinks differently or learns differently, that doesn't mean there's a deficit. What I've learned working with students is that what on paper might look like a lack of skills, when you put people in the right environment with their strong skill sets, they can really shine. And it's there's such importance about helping students understand where their strong skills are and helping them find those places. And then also giving them strategies to support where there's gaps. So difference equal deficit.
It's got to be huge when you have experiences where students come in and they're maybe a little bit unsure about their place and about especially their place in college, about, you know, again, like if we're college material, because all the stigma that comes with students with disabilities in that environment to, you know, help them find a place where that is a strength for them and to see them succeed in that.
Yeah. Building confidence is probably the most important work that I do. And confidence comes not from simply providing help. It's empowering students to understand that they are their own best help and they can come up with strategies and they can employ those strategies. It's not about depending on someone else. You are your own best help. You just got to figure out where the skills are and the strategies that work for you.
That was Tina Hardy. She's the coordinator for the Center of Accessibility and Neurodiversity at Illinois Valley Community College. Thank you so much for listening to Teacher's Lounge. As always, please feel free to nominate a teacher in your life to be on the show. It's how we get all of our guests like Tina. Send them our way to teacherslounge@niu.edu. Wherever you're hearing the podcast, subscribe to it, leave us a rating, share it with a friend. It really is the best way to get even more perspectives and nominations on the show. A big thank you to the Northern Illinois band Kind Ofs for the music you hear each and every episode of this show. And I have been your host, Peter Medlin. This is Teacher's Lounge.